Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, welcome back to the Daily Jungle. Another Monday in the books, and we had a very busy day. The Raiders clowning the Jets in their home opener. Denver dropping the hammer on the Cowboys, and Canelo Triple G. What a debacle that was. We also had an excellent guest day. Pittsburgh Steelers safety Mike Mitchell after the Steelers beat Minnesota to get to 2-0. He dominated that interview like he always does. Yahoo's Chris Mannix, who broke down Canelo Triple G, and Mississippi State football coach Dan Mullen right after the Bulldogs absolutely busted up LSU in Stark Vegas on Saturday night. Alvy, back in the saddle. Go ahead and roll it. Week 2 of the NFL. And you know, I see some folks saying that it was not that good of a week, not that impressive. It seems to me there are some things to talk about now. It was not that bad. In fact, it was pretty damn good. Week 2 of the NFL, and a lot to talk about. So many different places where I could start. As an example, Denver shutting down Ezekiel Elliott and the Dallas Cowboys, and Elliott getting hammered for, quote, quitting on his teammates. Atlanta dominating Green Bay, or Gronk 69 and groin. I mean, of course, those three words were going to be in the same sentence. Gronk 69 and groin. That joke practically writes itself, except it's not a joke. This time, he hauls in his 69th career TD reception and then hurts his groin and leaves the game. And while he says it's not that big of a deal, for a guy who gets hurt as often as he does, any injury is worrisome, especially the Pats, who are losing really important guys every single week. But as good as all that was, or is, there is still nothing better than what happened on the field in Oakland. Alvin, start this week the same way we started last week. Hit me with your music. Actually, make that what happened off the field in Oakland. The Raiders had their home opener against the Jets, which meant a couple of things were going to happen. Number one, the Raiders were going to win. Number two, the Jets were going to get humiliated and destroyed. And number three, Marshawn Lynch was going to make his official home debut, and he made it a memorable one.
Lynch to Carrs, left in the gun, 2x2, Crabtree Cooper right, they give it to Marshawn, Marshawn in the end zone, touchdown! Raiders! A beastly touchdown for Marshawn, his first as a Raider.
12 carries, 45 yards, and a touchdown's pretty nice. But you want to talk about getting nice. What he did on the sidelines made it legendary, because that's where good went to great and great went legendary. With the Raiders up 35-13 in the second half, the PA started bumping Oakland. Marshawn started dancing, and it was incredible.
You are looking live at Marshawn Lynch dancing to the music during the timeout, and the crowd has gone absolutely wild.
Quirky, unpredictable, entertaining.
Authentic.
Freaking awesome. You forgot that. Freaking awesome. One of my favorite things ever. They throw Marshawn up on the Jumbotron. The entire stadium was dancing right alongside him. And the love wasn't just felt in Oakland. It was felt around the world. Raiders GM Reggie McKenzie in the locker room, quote, "It was just joy. So much fun. And it was all natural. It just happened. Football needs more fun like that," end quote. LeBron on Instagram, quote, "Man, I love this dude. Straight up. Hashtag beast mode. Hashtag town fitness." Jim Rome on his radio show, quote, "Awesome. Absolutely awesome," end quote. I mean, that really was one of the all-time great moments, and a reminder yet again of how did this league ever survive without Marshawn Lynch. And the dance was nearly as good as the excerpt from the Raiders post-game press conference transcript. Question, was it what you imagined it would be like in your head? Marshawn nods head yes. Didn't even answer. Except not everybody enjoyed it. Not everybody loved it. The New York Jets, for one, didn't seem to be huge fans, like linebacker Jordan Jenkins.
"That irks my ever-living nerves. When I saw it happen, it just was infuriating. I wanted him to kick the ball short so he can actually jump and get some more contact. That pisses me off. I'm an old school guy. I don't like when things like that happen. I mean, that was embarrassing. Using like that, that Marshawn dancing like that, good player. But seeing that happen, I mean, that should infuriate the whole team. Should infuriate everybody, and we should have a good response coming in next Sunday.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of glad to hear that from Jenkins, because otherwise I'd be wondering if any of the Jets had a pulse, if any of the Jets had any pride or dignity left. And no, it's not going to, quote, infuriate the whole team. They're not going to use that as fuel for their game against Miami. Why not? Because they're the Jets. You see, Marshawn dancing was not embarrassing. Being the Jets is embarrassing. Allowing more than 400 yards for a second straight week is embarrassing. Starting out 0-2 is embarrassing. Marshawn dancing is not. Linebacker Darren Lee, quote, "It's their house. They can do whatever they want." But as a competitor, as a defender, you don't like to see that type of stuff. It's demoralizing, but we have to bow up and keep fighting, end quote. Hey, Darren, respectfully, demoralizing is not Marshawn dancing. Demoralizing is playing for the New York Jets. When you throw on the green and white in 2017, you're already telling us that you're demoralized. I don't need to see Marshawn dancing to know that you had your pride ripped right out of your heart, or your pride ripped out and your heart stomped on. There's more. Steve McClendon, nose tackle, also waiting. Quote, "We're upset because it seems like he was rubbing it in our face. But he's winning, man. He can do whatever he wants to do," end quote. Yeah, true. True. Which is exactly why I'm not going to go with that tired, lame, played-out cliche of, if you don't want him dancing, don't let him win. See, here's the thing. He was not rubbing it in your face. If he was rubbing it in your face, he would have done it on the field. The dance had nothing to do with you. Do you think that Marshawn even gives a crap about the Jets? You're the Jets. He wasn't dancing because he was beating the Jets. He was dancing because he's back in Oakland, because that was a special moment. Beating you had nothing to do with it. If anything, it might have taken away from the moment. He would have preferred to beat an actual NFL team instead of an assortment of cast-offs and tankers. Rubbing it in your face, I bet the guy doesn't even know who they played. He probably has no idea. I mean, I cannot stress this enough. I cannot stress enough how little this story or his dancing is about you or the Jets. You're a non-factor here. Just like you are in the season. Just like when you complain about it being demoralizing or how it, quote, irks your ever-living nerves. You're only embarrassing yourselves and reminding us that you're even around. You see, if anything, this was a chance for you to slip under the radar. The whole focus of the game should have been Marshawn's dancing, and we would have all forgotten who he was playing against. Honestly, it would have been a win for you. Your record would still be 0-2, but nobody would have remembered that you were on the other sideline when he was dancing on his. But then the guys in the Jets locker room started whining and crying and making it about themselves. And then, and only then, were we reminded that there was another team in the stadium and that it was that terrible. You had a chance to actually slip out the door and disappear into the night, but then you started to complain and you made it about you, and that made it 100 times worse. How Jets of you. Just when you thought they couldn't get any more embarrassing, they do. Trust me, again, he probably has no idea who he was playing. Stop making it about yourselves, losers. How Jets of them. Raider fan, 2 weeks in a row, I lead that Monday show with you and your song and your hype. Mike Mitchell is my guest. Mike, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Jim?
Good, Mike. Great to visit. Thanks so much. As a defense, Mike, you held the Vikings to 9 points yesterday, and the team has only given up one passing TD this season. Cam Hayward, Mike, said afterwards that the 9 points were still too many. So what's it say about the attitude of the defense that you hold a team to single digits and you're still not satisfied?
Yeah, I mean, we're just trying to continually be a group on the rise. You know, I felt like, you know, that was a very good football team. Case Keenum, obviously, though, was the backup quarterback, and it was unfortunate that we didn't get to play them with Sam Bradford. And so obviously that kind of probably helped us out a little bit, but I thought we still did a good job of taking care of the run game and limiting them in the pass game. But there's still a lot of plays out there that we left out there. You know, there was a 3rd-and-20 conversion that, you know, I had a hand in giving up. You know, then they proceeded to go on and score. We like to try to be as stingy as we can. So on a day like today especially, we're going to look at the tape and be very critical, because the goal for us is to win a world championship. We know what it's like to lose in the AFC championship to the eventual champion. We know the steps that we need to take, and that's what our focus is.
Steelers safety Mike Mitchell joining us. You know, Mike, to that point, I mean, those are the expectations in Pittsburgh. Anything less than a Super Bowl is going to be a disappointment. So from a player's perspective, I mean, how does that feel? Does it feel like unnecessary pressure, or does it feel like something of an honor and a challenge that you have to live up to?
For me, I mean, it comes, obviously there's a little bit of pressure, just from the standpoint of, you know, knowing you have to win. But then on the flip side of it, being a true competitor, what are you in the game for if not to win championships, win as many as you can? You know, for a guy like me and for every guy on this football team, we're a bunch of like-minded guys. Our goal when we wake up is to be a world champion. I think that's why you look at the success that we've had. I think that's why it is, because that's the way we think. That's the way our organization thinks. That's the way our coaches think. That's the way our owners think. That's the way that we go about our day-to-day business. When we walk through the doors, when I walked through the doors today, I did know that I had a little bit of my day set aside to where I was going to have an interview with you, but the rest is about how I'm going to improve from what I did yesterday so I can get ready to have a better performance versus the Chicago Bears next Sunday. And that's legitimately what my goal in life was for my Monday. And it is for Marquise Pouncey, it is for Ben Roethlisberger, it is for all the other guys on our team.
Mike Mitchell joining us. You know, Mike, you said we've got a bunch of like-minded guys. You actually said that in a different way recently. You said it back in camp, quote, "It's like you're an alpha male trying to outdo other alpha males." I love that line. Lay it out for me. What do you mean by that exactly?
When you look at just the sport we're in, you know, a lot of guys, you know, we lift a bunch of weight, we're strong, you know, there's that little bit of that ego of who's who and who's going to do what. And there's always that fight. You know, obviously, if you look at the game, just from a standpoint of simply moving a ball down the field, at one point, either the offense's will is going to continue to move that ball until you give up, until you get a score, or the defensive will is going to win. So there's always that battle, just down to the essence of the game. I truly believe that there are a bunch of alpha males out there, and that's exactly what you're trying to do, is conquer the other alpha male, and over the course of a game, someone wins and someone loses.
You know, I mean, definitely a game of gladiators, and I see that. Like, you're trying to get real estate, you're trying to move the ball down the field. But what if you get a locker room full of alpha males? It seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, it could go one of two ways, right? It could go really, really well if you're all pulling in the same direction, or it could go really badly if these alpha males start knocking heads, and then all of a sudden the team gets ripped apart. How do you make sure that doesn't happen when you've got so many strong personalities?
I think it's just the way that our culture is. You know, we're extremely competitive in practice, but ultimately we know why we're competitive in practice is to improve each other. You know, one of the rules that we go through early in the off season, you know, extremely early, because we don't really like to repeat talking about things, but we always say, you know, we want extremely tough guys, but we're not building MMA fighters. We got a couple dudes that on our team, myself included, that do a bunch of boxing and stuff in the off season, but when we're out here at practice, that's not the time to be practicing those things. At that point, it's how can I sharpen my sword for the battle, which is getting better for football.
Hey, Mike, you didn't happen to catch that Canelo Triple G fight, did you, being a boxing guy?
I did.
What do you make? What do you make of that, and what do you make of 118-10 Canelo?
Yeah, I mean, I feel just about I feel like everyone else. I think Teddy Atlas, I believe, said it best. You know, I'm almost sick of it. You know, these dudes, I actually have a couple friends that are UFC fighters, and it doesn't happen as often in the UFC, but as it does boxing, but it does still happen. You know, you see these dudes, they go in there, and they literally put their lives on the line. You know, you go out there, and you take a shin to the face, or you take an accumulative, you know, 100 punches, you know, you're losing a little bit of, you're losing your health when you come out of that ring. You are less healthy, for sure, when you come out of there versus when you went in there. And for a judge, I don't know. I could be being ignorant right here, but I'm assuming that Adelaide Bird has not professionally boxed, and I think it shows. By the way, if you looked at that scorecard, it shows. I haven't boxed at a professional level, but I've watched enough to know that she didn't watch the same fight that I did.
she didn't watch the same fight that any of us did. Mike, I totally agree with you. You know, the point that you made about you've got some friends in MMA and that literally they take their lives into their own hands when they go into that cage every single time. And then when they come out of that cage, probably they've lost a piece somehow of their lives. How is it different than the NFL, for instance? I mean, do you feel like MMA is that much more dangerous than what you do for a living?
They're very, very, very similar. But at the end of the day, my job, being violent, is a byproduct of what I'm ultimately trying to do. What I'm ultimately trying to do is get a man on the ground if he's running the ball, or break up a pass if a pass is thrown. I'm not particularly trying to hurt anyone. Whereas if you're fighting, you're fighting. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
You know, yes, I know that they call it a sport, but I mean, there's a huge difference. I play professional football. You don't play fighting.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, your job, you're right. Your job is to make a play. Your job is to get a guy on the ground. Your job is maybe to separate a guy from the ball. Is it ever your job to knock a guy out the way it is in boxing or MMA?
Yeah, absolutely not. You know, that sometimes unfortunately happens based on the way that I do play and just the violent nature of the game, you know, that sometimes receivers duck in. But, I mean, but if you look at it over the course of my career, I think I'm one of the guys that's gotten exponentially better at not hitting people in the head and KO. And I think when I first got in the league, there was a couple guys I did hit in the head and put to sleep. But now, you know, most of my hits, I had a really good one in the Browns game. I had one just yesterday in the game on number 82. You know, I'm getting very, very, very – I'm skilled. You know, I'm not just a guy that's out there running around without any control. You know, I'm skilled. I'm aiming where I'm hitting, and I'm hitting guys in the body legally.
82 is Kyle Rudolph. In fact, you made a great play on that one. You separated him from the ball. What did you see on that play, and then what's it feel like when you hit a guy, you time it perfectly, and you're able to separate the player from the ball? What's that feel like?
It obviously feels good. You know, obviously I made a play for my team, which obviously that's the number one reason I feel good. I know I did something that my brothers are going to look at and be like, yeah, you know, good job, Mike. And that's what makes it cool to play here in Pittsburgh, because I think that's why everyone's playing. But besides that, you know, it's the feeling of, you know, that play right there, that was a win for me, just being dominant. I like to play physical, and that was an opportunity for me to put my physicality on display. Which, you know, your tape, Coach T always tells us your tape is your resume. So I like to put that out there as much as I can. That's that.
Yeah. Mike, one last thought. You know, you mentioned we've talked around this issue, the Steeler way. But for instance, when Joe Hayden came over, Joe Hayden said, quote, "It's a different feel over here. It's a different vibe." So how would you describe the vibe that comes with being a Steeler? What's he talking about exactly?
It's hard to explain. But I'm joking. We joke around with Joe a lot. But Joe, just this is the first time in his career he started 2-0. So we want to keep his streak going and try to keep improving it every single week. Joe's been excellent in joining our culture and being the type of guy that we want in our room and on our defense and on our team. I'm super happy that we got him. I just look forward to continuing to see where we can grow and get to.
Canelo v. Triple G. All right, so we talked a lot about that fight coming in, and I actually was one of the people saying it's going to be a great fight. It should be the fight of the year. Go ahead and throw your money down for that. We're not going to be disappointed. It's going to be a great fight because styles make fights, and these guys are both coming forward. Triple G, no matter what, is coming forward, and although Canelo is a great, great counterpuncher, you know that he'd be aggressive and try to bring the fight right back. So there was no doubt in my mind that was going to be a great fight. Now, having seen the fight, I'm going to say it was a very good fight. Not exactly what I promised you, but a good fight. A very good fight, in fact. But not the war we expected. Not the fight of the century. Maybe not even the fight of the year. But a very good fight between two of the best fighters in the world. And I paid for it, and I was happy with my ROI. I didn't feel like I got sucker punched. I didn't feel like I got ripped off. I didn't feel like I got punched in the junk. It didn't completely live up to the hype, but it was a damn good fight. Just not Hagler Hearns type, like Oscar De La Hoya was talking about in the run-up. But again, a good fight. So I'm thinking, the fight's a good fight. I got my money's worth. I'm happy about that. Let's just wait for the judges' scorecards. Let's wait for Triple G to be announced as the winner. You know, maybe they get cute with it. Maybe there's a little bit of suspense with a split decision. And then we wait for the inevitable talk of a rematch. But it was pretty cut and dried, pretty basic. That did not happen because of an imbecilic scorecard belonging to one Adelaide Bird. I tweeted right as it happened. I'll say it again right here. If we know your name as a judge, that's a real problem. 118-110 Canelo is an absolute joke. You can't score that fight that way. If you score that fight that way, either you're totally incompetent or you're on the take. It's one of those two things. It cannot be anything else because there's no way you could sit ringside and score that fight that way and save this bullcrap about how it's totally subjective. No one, anyone, much less somebody sitting ringside who is allegedly qualified or credible, could have possibly have seen that fight that way. There's nobody anywhere in the world who saw that fight that way except for that judge. I mean, I'd even allow for somebody to give the nod to Canelo in a really close fight, even though I know for a fact Triple G won. He won the fight, flat out. He won the fight. But if you have an off night and you want to score to draw, or you even want to score the fight in favor of Canelo by a round or two, it's not the end of the world. But Bird scoring this one, 118-110, might be. Or maybe the beginning of the end of boxing as we know it. And I used to always think that no matter what happens to that sport, no matter how many black eyes there are, no matter what, you cannot kill boxing. There's no way to kill boxing. You couldn't do it. Even if you tried to ban the sport, it would reemerge someplace else. You cannot kill boxing. But after seeing something like that, I wonder. Because again, nobody has that bad of a night. Ever. You score that fight that way, and you are either incompetent or you're on the take. And I don't think it's the latter. And even worse, well, that's the worst night she's ever had. Well, that's the worst night any judge has ever had. It's not like it's a one-off for her either. She's had plenty of other bad nights. There are promoters on record protesting her working before big fights, yet she continues to get big fights. Because not only do they know that this could happen, promoters, they expect it to happen. And old Adelaide rarely disappoints. Did you see ESPN's Teddy Atlas after the fight? I thought my man was going to stroke out right there on live television. Dude was absolutely apoplectic. Look, I've never done this before, but now for the first time in my career, I want to know who the judges are before I buy a pay-per-view. Because if she's there, I'm not buying it. Hell, I want to know who the judges are before I start to talk about a fight several weeks out on this show. Because if she's part of it, I'm not going to waste any time breaking down something that I'm not going to watch or be a party to. Here's the bottom line. One of boxing's best nights of the year turned out to be one of the worst nights ever. A gigantic black eye for the sport in a sport that long ago ran out of eyes to dot. And the irony again is this. All those boxing purists running around before the Mayweather-McGregor fight talking about how that bout was an insult to boxing. The worst thing that could happen to boxing. And then boxing turns around on its biggest stage and kicks itself right in the junk. I find that pretty rich. Pretty rich. Mayweather-McGregor was going to ruin boxing, but Triple G Alvarez was going to save boxing. That's rich. It's not even their fault. They both fought pretty good fights. That was a good fight. I was happy with that fight. Until this. And we're not talking about that, are we? This whole notion of, yeah, well, it's fixed. It's corrupt. They want a rematch. There was going to be a rematch anyway. There was going to be a rematch regardless of how they scored that thing. Because it was competitive. Because it's the best the sport has to offer. How does she keep getting gigs? How did she get that gig? I mean, dozens and dozens and dozens of title fights. But again, promoters on record before fights is saying, we're not having that. We're not having her. She's not qualified. And now you see why. Dear Rome, I'm boxing is better than Savage UFC guy, but damn. Saturday's judges embarrassed me so badly that yesterday I bought a week's worth of affliction gear along with cases of Monster because I'm a UFC guy now. I'm done with you, boxing, until you bring in robot judges. John in Huntington Beach. CSF grad. Wore the Takati ring girls. Hey John, I was in your hood yesterday. That baseball game that I saw my son play, Troy High School, right down the street from CSF. That's even like boxing guys saying, I'm going over to the other side now. Dana White was incredible. Dana White jumped on Twitter like 4 seconds after the decision. He tweets at the NSAC, Nevada State Athletic Commission, quote, that is disgusting. It was, Dana. Manny Pacquiao jumped on Twitter. Did they bring these judges over from Australia? Hey-o, Manny.
Hey-o.
Good one, Manny. Hey, Manny, we're still waiting for an apology from you about your fight with Mayweather. Stop piling on other people's fights. Daniel Cormier tweeted, Adelaide Bird gave Canelo 10 rounds? L-M-A-O. Jeremy Lin piled on. He tweeted, this is rigged and awful. Boxing just ruined one of its best fights. And you know it's bad when another professional athlete just literally comes right out and says, the fix was in. Quote, this is rigged. It's Jeremy Lin, Harvard guy too. Again, why do you need to rig it? Why do you need to fix it? Oh, because it's all about the money. They need a rematch. You were going to have a rematch anyway. Was there any doubt that there'd be a rematch when that fight ended? Andre Iguodala tweeted, terrible, terrible, terrible. 118-110, boxing ain't going to ever get it. Lennox Lewis tweeted, here we go again. These scorecards were ridiculous. Conor McGregor tweeted, boxing is a mad game. Chris Mannix. You know, when it comes to Saturday night's fight, Chris, I'm going to jump right into it. There's a lot of talk, but we have to start with the judging. And you yourself had been saying all week long prior to that fight that people have to keep an eye on Judge Adelaide Bird. Before we get into her scoring of the fight, lay out the history that gave you that feeling. Why was that somebody that you said we had to keep an eye on?
Well, there are a couple of things. First, it's my own experience at being at fights that she judged. Probably two or three that I can remember. Austin Trout, Miguel Cotto. There was a Nonito Donaire fight recently that I was at and scored myself, where my card and really, frankly, everybody else's card was vastly different from Adelaide Bird. So coming into it, I had my own experience where I thought she made some questionable calls. And if you go back a year, Top Rank, another promoter, they filed an official protest. They told the Boxing Nevada Commission that they didn't want Adelaide Bird on one of their shows because they had questions about her ability to score a fight properly. Those two things combined, as soon as I saw her name, it made me wonder what kind of scorecard she was going to submit.
Chris Mannix joining us. All right, so if that's the case, and even Top Rank had previously attempted to get her removed from judging a featherweight fight a year ago, what was she doing there as judge in the biggest fight of the year?
You know, it's a great question. It's one that I asked Bob Bennett, the executive director of the Nevada State Commission, directly after the fight, and he said he believes that through his own research and through his own system that Adelaide Bird is one of the best judges he has. And I honestly, Jim, I find that to be incredible that is a belief. I mean, look, there are, I'm sure, plenty of fights that she judged properly. He told me she's been in 115 title or title-level fights, and in his opinion, she's judged the majority of them properly. But there are far too many glaring examples of, you know, incompetence, frankly, and bad judging that to think that she should be in this type of fight. Moreover, you know, there is no national, you know, rating system for boxing judging, which I think is incredible. How is there not a national rating system for judging in the same way that the NBA and NHL and NFL and even baseball have a system in place to judge their referees and officials and umpires and put the best on their biggest events? How does boxing not have a national system? How does the Nevada State Athletic Commission, the supposed preeminent commission in all of boxing, not have a national rating system? But even if you don't, you know, after the fight was over, Jim, I went out there and I texted with and I talked to a bunch of people in boxing and asked them to give me the names of their, or who they think are the best judges. And these names all came back the same. It was Steve Weisfeld. It was Max DeLuca. It was Bert Clements. You know, probably five or six names came back consistently in these calls and text messages. Why is it that everybody else in boxing has a list of the best judges in there, and Nevada doesn't use them. Why does Nevada think it's smarter than everybody else? Why won't they go out of state with judges more frequently? You would think, Jim, that an event like this, their second biggest event of the year and certainly the most significant fight in terms of consequence of the year, you would want to have the three best judges, regardless of gender, race, nationality, whatever. You think they want the three best judges, and at least in one case, I think they should have known going in that they didn't have one.
Chris Mannix joining us. All right, Chris, bottom line it. Is she not a good judge, or is there something more sinister or more suspicious going on here?
You know, I really hesitate to, you know, play the corruption card, and because I just don't have any evidence. And I snooped around a little bit, and you know, even people that I thought would go there, they weren't willing to go there. And given that her cards have been wide frequently, it just makes me think that sometimes she just doesn't have an appreciation for certain aspects of the sport. And I was talking on my podcast last night to Steve Farhood, and Steve, who's with Showtime, he knows Adelaide Byrd pretty well. The one thing he brought up is that in some fights, it seems like Adelaide does not have an appreciation for the impact of the jab. And one thing Golovkin did really well in this fight was throw that jab. He was just peppering Canelo's face with that jab. And, you know, from his perspective, and I can see it now that I really think about it, it does make some sense that she didn't really appreciate the jab as much as she should have, because the jab is a point-scoring weapon. That's why guys use it. They should be getting credit for it, and Adelaide Byrd didn't give him the credit for it.
Memo to Adelaide, the judge or the jab is here to stay in boxing. All right, it's not going anywhere. It's an important part of the sport. Listen,
yeah, and Jim, let me just say, I mean, look, for Golovkin, it's frustrating. I get that. I mean, I talked to him alone briefly afterwards, and I've interviewed him dozens of times. I've been up to Big Bear and worked with him and been around him a lot. This was as frustrated down as I've seen Gennady Golovkin. All that being said, he's getting his rematch. He'll make millions more in the next fight. It doesn't affect his bottom line. Where judging affects people, and I hear from young boxers, not just last night, but all the time when stuff like this comes up. Young boxers text me. Managers of these boxers will text me. Where it affects guys is that when you have a judge that doesn't know what he or she is doing, if they make a bad call on a young fighter's fight, that affects their career in exponential ways. That's the difference for some fighters in the ability to pay rent over the next few months and not paying rent. These guys, their careers are predicated on wins on these off-TV fights that nobody's watching. So when judging is bad, it has an incredible impact on the career of younger guys. And that should be the biggest reason why there is an overhaul of the judging system, a national rating system is put in place, and three and the top judges get the top fight.
Chris Mannix joining us. It's a very, very good point. I mean, no matter what, these guys were going to fight again. That's part of the argument that for those who are trying to argue, and I said it myself, Chris, either she's totally incompetent or the fix is in. But like you, I'm not going to say that it's the latter, and I know it, because the fact of the matter is they were going to fight again anyway, regardless of what happened. In fact, let me ask you this. If she had scored it 115-113 for Canelo, are we even having this conversation right now?
We absolutely are not having this conversation. There were people on press row, and I scored the fight a draw for the record, but there were people on press row around me that had the fight 115-113 for Canelo. I don't see it. I didn't think he was as active as Golovkin was, and again, I credit the jab more than others, but I understood it. I mean, Canelo did land the majority of power shots. It was 114-110 in favor of Canelo with power shots, and there were some vicious shots that he landed that you could see him winning rounds as a result of that. But it's 15-13. We are not sitting here talking about the judging. We are just, you know, frankly, giddy for the idea of a rematch between two guys that I think acquitted themselves pretty well, and I think we'll put together a great fight in May.
All right, so in terms of strategy, I thought Canelo came out very aggressively. In fact, I thought that he was going to get Triple G out of there. I thought he looked great in the beginning. I thought Triple D looked they looked tight. I thought he was not comfortable. But then Canelo seemed to let him back into the fight. What did you make of that strategy and the way Canelo fought in the middle rounds?
I think Canelo got tired, to be honest with you. And look, it takes a lot of effort to move as much as he had to move through the first three rounds of that fight. I mean, he was constantly backpedaling, constantly in motion. And that's what you have to do. I mean, you stand to trade with Gennady Golovkin. That's, you know, basically suicide by Kazakhstani. I mean, it's not a smart strategy to do that. That being said, in the fourth round, he looked tired, and he started fighting against the ropes. And I thought Golovkin, probably aware of Canelo's power at that point, was a little more hesitant than I thought he was going to be. I thought if he really opened up on Canelo, he would have had a chance to do some more damage, stop him, maybe throw some body shots in between. I think as Canelo looks forward to the next fight, it's got to be conditioning that is priority number one. I don't think he can fight that same way and expect to beat Gennady Golovkin again.
All right, so Gennady Golovkin's now 35, Chris. Any idea, if you had to guess, and it's so hard, any idea how much that fight would take out of a 35-year-old guy? And then what do you think the rematch looks like?
I think it takes something out of him. Hard to say what it takes out of him overall. I mean, Golovkin is as finely conditioned an athlete as I've seen. I mean, guys usually, you know, Golovkin Jim's been fighting at 160 forever.
Right.
You know, and usually guys, when they get into their 30s, it's move up in weight. They don't want to make 160, but the day before the fight, he was weighing 161 and eating a regular dinner. So I think his conditioning is going to help him age a little bit better, but he is going to slow down a little bit more. I thought the difference in hand speed was glaring in this fight, in the sense that Canelo had a far better hand speed, and Golovkin's slow punches, while impactful, were, you know, just a little bit on the slower side in this fight. So I think he's going to have enough left in the tank to make the next fight just as good, if not better, than this one. But we are definitely in the twilight of Gennady Golovkin's career. 2018 might be the last year we see him as close to his best.
And then finally, you made a really emphatic plea that there has to be a change in the system. There has to be a better way of doing this. Is anything going to change as a result of what we saw happen?
No, nothing. It's boxing. They are so willing to cut their nose off to spite their face. They have no interest whatsoever in making the time and the investment needed to make the changes that we're talking about. When I talked to Bob Bennett, you know, he was almost defiant in some ways talking to me about Adelaide Byrd, more interested in discussing her bona fides than discussing her weaknesses as a judge. And, you know, look, I would love to see the Nevada Commission and even the governor of Nevada say, look, we've got to fix this. We are no longer the greatest commission in the world. After basically allowing Floyd Mayweather to decide what equipment is used in the ring, followed up by this event, the Nevada Commission looks terrible. So I'd love to see the governor and the commission, you know, put together the funds to create a rating system, have the best in the world come in for these types of big fights. But I have received no indication that anything is going to change, and that's why stuff like this in boxing is going to continue to happen.
Chris, I got 1 minute. Why is that a hill that Bennett is willing to die on, defending Adelaide Byrd? For who? For what?
Look, I don't really have a big problem with him defending her as vehemently as he did in that moment. You don't want to sit there and say, my judge is terrible. But if he goes back and watches the fight and he does not hear a good explanation for her in the coming days, she should not be allowed anywhere near at least a major fight, and maybe not near any fight again.
So when I say to you, Eddie and Boise, what's the first thing that goes through your mind? Maybe it's something like this.
Seeing the Vikings standing on the banks of the what do we do now, River?
Eddie, what is up?
Hey, Vine. Thanks for the Vine room. Her name was Rachel. She was a clone girl. Whenever she would go on air, we'd get the Brickyard NASCAR scare. Eric in Falls Church, he's got a problem. His emails never match the hype. His social life is
now,
stuck.
I could talk
outside
over this, but why
the
would I? I can't step on that brilliance.
Because it's about you.
Get it, Ed!
Now, though, what do we do now, River? Has a hold
get
of
it,
you
Ed.
At Bohica. Brad and Corona.
See the way he worked in a Bohica reference to that? The Copa Bohica? I don't even know where he was going with that back then. Anyway, he's back now after all this time. I do not even remember the last time Eddie and Boise called. It had to have been one of those calls that we just replayed. But here he is right now, live. Let's go to Boise. Eddie in Boise. Eddie, if you had to guess, bro, when was the last time you called this show?
I'm having flashbacks, Jim.
We all are.
It's been a while. It's probably over a year and a half, probably.
Okay.
At least. I was at that Charger game yesterday, Jim. I felt bad for San Diego Charger fans. There were more Dolphin fans than Charger fans. And if I can be specific about what I mean, I say there was a 2-to-1 ratio of Dolphin to Charger fans, but and I'm talking about San Diego Charger fans. To the average viewer on TV, when you span the, I mean, there's 25,000 people there out of 29,000 at the StubHub.
Eddie, I got to help you out with something. All right, I know it's been a long time. There was a lot of rust, obviously, to knock off. You weren't ready. Let me take you back, Ed, to a much better time.
Her name was Rachel. She was a
now, Eddie, this
girl.
Is when you were in your prime.
Whenever she would go
this
on
is
air,
when you were fighting Trim.
NASCAR
this
scares.
Is when you were at the
Eric
very top
Foster.
Of your game.
He's got a problem.
This is when you came in here
his
and you ragdog fools.
His social life is stuck
this
outside.
Is this
the
is like you looking back like Facebook memories 5 years
you.
Ago and you're
now, though,
shredded
what do we
and
do
you
now,
look
River?
Great.
Had
that's what that is.
You
now listen to this carefully.
Bohica,
this is what you need to aspire to.
Corona, we're
because that's not how you sound. That's who you want to be. Go back, Ed. Get it. Go find what you just lost. John in Little Rock. John, what's up? Good morning.
Good morning. What's up, Rome? I like to say to the sports world, we're having great football out of college and NFL. Keep it rolling, everybody. I'm loving it. And as for Mr. Ed, hey, Edward, you've lost your mojo. If you call the show with warm or boring sports take, I will puke up. Hey, Eddie, bring us the action. You could be your worst or be your best. Just rip the sports take out your chest, your Eddie. You've lost your mojo. How did I make up this parody so quick about your soulness? I don't know.
John, nice job. Rack him. Dan Mullen is my guest. Dan, nice to have you back on. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Always great to be with you.
You too, Dan. Thanks so much. Now, when you're a head coach, obviously you're going to have some extreme highs and some extreme lows. You've had a lot of big wins in your career at Mississippi State, but where does beating number 11 LSU by 30 on Saturday rank among the best wins?
You know what? It was up there. It was up there. We've had some big ones. The year we went to number one in the season that year, we had a bunch of big wins and some early on. But, through the years, a bunch of them. But I know the atmosphere Saturday night at Davis-Wade Stadium, our fans put on, I mean, it was electric. And they were rocking from before kickoff. You know, to be honest with you, after the game and I was driving home, I think they were all still rocking out in the parking lot, and I think some of them were still there Sunday morning when I drove into the office to get back to work on this next game. They were still partying. So it was a great atmosphere and a fun night here in Stark Vegas.
I was going to say, Dan, that's exactly where I was going to go next. You and I have talked about Stark Vegas in the past and about the home field advantage you have when you play there. But, I mean, really, and you touched on it, but how special is it to have a win like that in front of those hometown fans?
Well, it's huge for them, you know what I mean? Because it's, you know, I don't the rivalry game. I mean, half of Mississippi is closer to Baton Rouge than Starkville, so you know, there's a lot of being right near each other. You know, there's a lot of rivalry between neighborhoods and friends and families of people that live close by, and so I know they love getting that big win in that way and getting bragging rights for this year anyway.
All right, you got a huge challenge coming up again this weekend, which I'll get to. I know you're never going to get ahead of yourself, but when you have a win like that, does it feel like a declaration that Mississippi State is back?
I don't know about that, you know, because especially when you're in the SEC, and for us, because your reward of beating a top 15 team one week is to play somebody that's ranked even higher the next week, and that kind of seems to be life in this league sometimes. It's not about the one game. It's the, you know, it's the week after week after week of the schedule that you have to play. So, you know, it was a great win for us. I think it showed our guys right now that we can go out there and play with just about anybody in the country if we play hard and execute at a high level. And but, you know, we have a new challenge ahead of us, having to go do it on the road against a team that might even be more talented than LSU.
Mississippi State head coach Dan Mullen joining us. Dan, I want to talk to you about your quarterback, Nick Fitzgerald. He had nearly 270 total yards. He had 3 touchdowns on Saturday. This was not a highly recruited player. In fact, only small schools were interested in him. You've got an amazing reputation for developing quarterbacks. What did you see in him that made you think that he might be special?
Well, you know what? He came to our camp, and he was a high school receiver, and his high school coach said, hey, he can really throw it. He's a quarterback, but we run the wishbone. And he had a guy in front of him that was a senior that ran the wishbone, ended up, I think, going to the Citadel or, you know, one of the a military school and ran the option in college. And so he said, but he can really throw it. And so, you know, John Hevesy, our line coach, went down to and watched him practice during his spring of his junior year, and they were throwing it around and doing some drills, and he really, the ball jumped out of his hands. He has great size at about 6'4", 6'5", and he's about 240 pounds. But our line coach came back and said, hey, he's got receiver speed, he runs the wishbone, and he's got a big arm, and the high school coach said they don't run that offense, so you're not going to get to see it. So we got him up to our camp, and we got to work with him and realized, hey, he's got arm talent. Even though he's not in one of these systems and throwing it all over the place, we can coach him how to play quarterback and how to make reads, but I can't coach him how to be 6'5", 230 pounds, can run and really have a strong arm. It's hard to coach those things, you know. So we figure, you know, here's this guy that has the skill set we're looking for. We just got to go work hard and teach him all the fundamentals, techniques, and reads and what it is, the specifics of being a quarterback.
Yeah, in terms of fundamentals, right? You can't coach those things. You can't coach 6'4", you can't coach 6'5". He's got all these great, great things, but you can't coach fundamentals. And I've heard you talk about this in the past, that young quarterbacks need to understand that while the chicks might dig the long ball, they don't dig the checkdowns, but you want to make exactly – you want to make certain that the players understand this, that the average play is the right play. It's tough for young quarterbacks to embrace that. How do you sell that to them?
Well, it just takes time. As you said, chicks dig the long ball, you know. And so when they're up there, hey, we're at a game, and there's, you know, there's 15,000 students, and, you know, by odds you're saying probably 7,500 of them are college girls watching you play, and they're on TV watching. They want to see the touchdown pass on SportsCenter highlight, you know. SportsCenter doesn't throw, oh, there he goes on the 30. Hey, he checks it down in the flat on this fourth progression in the read, and it's second down and six. That doesn't make SportsCenter, but it wins you a lot of football games. And so I think he does a fabulous job of learning. He's starting to come on now, and you've seen it game by game of him understanding what the understanding the defense, understanding what we're trying to accomplish offense, and just take what the defense gives you and move the ball up and down the field and win football games. That's the most important thing you can do.
So once again, you win a big football game like that, and what's the reward? You play a team that's probably more talented, ranked even higher. This is how the SEC works. So when you come off that huge win, and then you've got to get ready for Georgia, how do you go about getting your guys to shift from celebrating that win to preparing for the next challenge and doing it quickly?
Well, we came in early this morning and put that game to rest before classes. So the guys got in here early. You know, we go through, you know, how we won that game. We watch a couple clips of the film and clean that up and put it to rest. And they come back this afternoon. It's 100% focus on Georgia on the next game. And it's great because, you know, all the people that are walking around campus that are patting them on the back right now, I explain, it really is only about 12 inches, and they're kicking them in the rear end next week. So if they like the pats on the back, make sure they keep those hands up high, and we get back to work so that pat in the back doesn't turn to a kick in the ass next week.
Dan Mullen joining us. Well said. All right, so now we get to the important stuff before you go. There was a report last week that your music playlist includes Tupac, U2, NWA, Jimmy Buffett, and Taylor Swift. There's some amazing range in that, Dan. I respect it if it's true. Is it true?
100%. I go out, I run every morning, and you know what? I got like a mixed run tape, and I shuffle. You know, and sometimes I'm sitting there and I'm running, and you know, there are people run by you in the morning, and I don't know out all over the country. You know, we're out here in Mississippi, so I don't use the headphones. I just let it play because I like to listen to some nature too. So it just plays loud on my phone. So like an old school, like, you know, I'm running down the street with an old school beatbox playing out there. But it is, and then sometimes I'll see people run by me, and I'm wondering, okay, boy, those people just ran by me. I got Taylor Swift playing. They're like, what a weirdo this guy must be, or something like that. Or even though I like Taylor Swift, and then the next time I got some NWA going, and they're like, wow, you know, our coach is kind of thugged up a little bit. I don't know. I enjoy music. I enjoy all of it on there, you know, and I tell you what, I love, just saw the show with Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre on HBO. I thought that was unbelievable. I'm a big music fan, and now U2 capitalizes it all, because I'm a big, big, big U2 fan, I'm a huge parrot head with Jimmy Buffett. But you got to have that mix of everything in there just to keep you well-rounded.
But that show you're talking about is the Defiant Ones. I mean, that's amazing. So what is it with the no ear pods or no headphones? Are you worried about cars coming by, or do you just want to hear those tunes?
You know what it is? Is I used to run with the headphones, and then I don't know. I got some case on my phone, and I couldn't plug my headphones
right
into one day, And I'm like, all right, well, I'm just going to listen to it. And I realized, you know what, I get to hear some of nature, and you get to kind of enjoy things with the music in the background. Instead of blocking out the whole world, you kind of feel one with nature out there running around. And, you know, we're not in the big city here in Starkville, so I don't think I annoy people with my music playing when I'm out running in the morning.
I'm going to try it. I think you ended up with some, like, third-party product that didn't fit in, so the headphones didn't work. That makes sense.
That's what it is. You know, that's my new invention. So now I just run with the music playing in the background and enjoy nature a little bit too.
Patent it. Dan, last thought. Your shoe game is always incredibly strong, especially your Yeezy game. How are the kicks treating you these days?
Well, it's fantastic. You know, I mean, fortunately, I got a bunch of different stuff, you know, with the Yeezys. I got all the new NMDs from Adidas, which are some of the most comfortable shoes, and they're making them kind of swagged out. And, you know, the great thing that somehow, I don't know if it's cool. The players make fun of me sometimes, and some people do think it's cool. We've created that I can wear a suit and get away with wearing a suit and comfortable sneakers as long as they're kind of like cool, swagged out shoes. And so everybody's got to wear uncomfortable shoes sometimes. I'm in these great, like, you know, I'm in my Yeezys or NMDs while I'm wearing a suit, and somehow I've made that cool, so I get to be comfortable while I'm all dressed up.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, you got to be a certain kind of guy to pull that off. You got to have a certain kind of swag to pull that off. I've thought about that. I can't do that yet. So it's all about how you kind of represent, right? You just kind of sell it. You got to project. You got to own it. And if you do that, you can do it.
That's what it is, you know. I mean, you got to have the sock game with it, too. I like going with the crazy socks. And if you have fun with it and you enjoy it right there, you can pull it off. And somehow I've managed to do it from, whether I'm wearing some Stan Smiths, some Yeezys, the NMDs, I don't know. You just wear it all, some custom-painted Adidas shoes, you know, with the turtle shell shoes. You gotta have some fun with it.
Yeah, see, my game's not that strong, but Stan Smith, that will never not work. Stan Smith will never not be cool, right?
That's what it is, you know. I mean, you can wear it with anything.
Thanks a ton for listening. I appreciate you very much. And thank you for downloading the Jim Rome podcast. Another episode drops tomorrow. Check back then. We are out.